This episode includes discussions about sexual assault and body mutilation. Please take care before listening.
The opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Murderish podcast. Sensitive topics are discussed. Listener discretion is advised.
In 1987, 25-year-old Oregon native Jennifer Smith was viciously murdered in a Denny's parking lot. She had no idea how important her death would end up being. Jennifer's determination to not go down without a fight would be a key factor in connecting seven other women's murders to a sadistic serial killer. The person responsible for a string of senseless murders was consumed by an evil bloodlust. His true form was hidden beneath a deceptive veneer. Those in his life only saw what he wanted them to see. He was perceived as a loving family man and successful entrepreneur. Lurking beneath the surface, however, was the worst kind of predator, someone who only experiences joy when others are in agony. It would be a long road to capture the man deemed the Molalla Forest killer, and an even longer road to bring him to justice. This is Jamie, and you're listening to Murderish. Join me as I explore the case of the Molalla Forest killer. This case takes us to the Portland area in Clackamas County, Oregon. In the late 1980s, Portland was established as a progressive city with a vibrant music scene. The cost of living was relatively low, but crime was high. Violence in the city was notable enough to spawn the Fox reality TV show Cops. More often than not, drug addiction was at the root of most violent crimes. Roughly 40 miles southwest of Portland is the Molalla River State Park. The preserve's 567 acres are densely packed with lush woodlands, picturesque aquatic landscapes, and a variety of wildlife. With dozens of trails and undeveloped land for miles around, the state park can feel eerily isolated. Tragically, for seven women, the Molalla Forest would become their final resting place. Portland's Union Avenue takes center stage in this case. Though it was renamed Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in 1989, there's no erasing its history of racism and violent crime. Pre-World War II, Union Avenue was populated by European immigrants who had an easy commute to their railroad and shipbuilding jobs. After the war, these immigrants spread out to other parts of the city. Prejudicial real estate practices, such as redlining, forced most Black residents to stay in the neighborhood. Several Black-owned businesses thrived on Union Avenue in the 1950s, but the vein of racial discrimination that ran through Portland meant predominantly Black neighborhoods were left out of urban renewal initiatives. In the 60s and 70s, Union Avenue began to noticeably decline. Crime exploded, pushing businesses to close their doors for good or start over in the suburbs. By the 1980s, Union Avenue had earned a reputation as Portland's danger zone. As Gary C. King described in his book, Bloodlust, Portrait of a Serial Sex Killer, the street had burned out buildings, boarded up storefronts, and barred windows, and was full of hitchhikers, shootings, stabbings, and street fights. Throughout the 1980s, Union Avenue represented rock bottom. It was the only place in Portland where a social outlier, a runaway, a felon, or an addict could live in relative anonymity. Unfortunately, that also made its inhabitants a viable target for someone with sinister intentions. Jennifer Lisa Smith was one of many sex workers who frequented Union Avenue. Everyone called her Jenny. The mother of two had been down on her luck when she turned to working the streets. Jenny knew it was dangerous work, but she liked to believe that she knew which Johns to stay away from. There was a vetting system of sorts on the streets. Fellow sex workers looked out for each other. If a client gave off creepy vibes, you heard about it. Jenny had gone out with a man known as Steve the Gambler twice before. Sure, he had a serious foot fetish and he liked to play rough, but Jenny believed Steve was harmless. He was friendly and always paid well, which was more than Jenny could say about most of her clients. In the early morning hours of August 7, 1987, Steve pulled up next to Jenny in his Nissan pickup truck. When Steve beckoned her for a date, Jenny had no reason to hesitate. Steve was as friendly as ever, and she needed the money. She climbed into his truck, and off they went. They headed toward the suburbs south of Portland. Steve made a pit stop at a 7-Eleven, where he bought ingredients for his favorite low-effort cocktail, a screwdriver. He paid for several mini bottles of Smirnoff vodka, along with a few single-serve plastic orange juice containers. A short time later, Steve and Jenny pulled into the parking lot of a small strip mall in the town of Oak Grove. It was around 3 a.m., so all of the businesses were closed, except for one. A 24-hour Denny's restaurant accounted for the half-dozen cars that speckled the parking lot. Steve parked his truck in the very back of the lot, a considerable distance from the restaurant. Jenny assumed that Steve just wanted some privacy. He'd mentioned bondage when they arranged their date. Less than 30 minutes later, several Denny's customers heard a woman screaming from the far corner of the parking lot. A few of them called 911. Other witnesses sprung into action. By following the sound of the screams, they caught sight of a man crouching over the body of a nude, injured woman. He was clutching a knife. According to the Statesman Journal, as the witnesses bravely approached, the man ran away and hid behind a nearby building. Somehow, he managed to climb into his pickup truck before fleeing the scene. Panicked witnesses stayed with Jenny as she struggled to breathe. By the time EMTs arrived, it was too late. Jennifer Smith died in the hospital a short time later. One Denny's customer did some quick thinking and tailgated Steve for several miles to jot down his license plate number. The plate number was a critical piece of information. It pointed investigators straight to the real identity of Steve the Gambler. His name was Dayton Rogers. Dayton Leroy Rogers was born in Moscow, Idaho in 1954. He was the youngest of three children, born to Ortiz and Jasperelle Rogers. His parents moved the family around frequently. They spent several years in Washington State before moving to Corvallis, Oregon. When the Rogers family adopted four daughters, Dayton was no longer the baby of the family. He felt like the spotlight was stolen away from him. In a bid for attention, Dayton began to act out in minor ways. Before long, Dayton turned to petty crime. At age 16, he was arrested for shooting a BB gun at passing cars. As a first-time juvenile offender, he only received a slap on the wrist. But as the years went on, Dayton's behavior revealed he was capable of inflicting great harm. In August of 1972, when Dayton was 18, he was convicted of second-degree assault. At the time, Dayton drove his 15-year-old girlfriend into a wooded area of Eugene, Oregon, so they could fool around. Things got rough, and Dayton ended up stabbing the girl in the stomach with a hunting knife. Bizarrely, Dayton's response was to propose marriage. His girlfriend was quickly losing blood. In a panic, she managed to convince Dayton to drive her to a hospital. Medical staff promptly summoned police. Dayton ended up pleading guilty to the assault charge, but was only sentenced to 4 years probation. About a year after the assault, Dayton had another run-in with the law. This time, he was charged with second and third degree assault. He'd tied up two 15-year-old girls in the back of his car and sexually assaulted them with a soda bottle. According to Jennifer Chambers' book, Murder and Mayhem in the Willamette Valley, Dayton was acquitted by reason of mental disease or defect and sent to a state mental hospital for care. He spent less than a year in a state institution before being released. For several years, it seemed Dayton was gravitating toward a normal life. He called Canby, Oregon, his home, a suburban town about 20 miles south of Portland. In October of 1975, Dayton married Sherry Miller. Author Jennifer Chambers described Sherry as docile, quiet, religious. These personality traits made her fiercely loyal to Dayton. Sherry had been raised in an old-fashioned household where she was taught that husbands should never be questioned. It was a wife's duty to turn a blind eye to the sins of her betrothed. So when an onslaught of rape charges were filed against Dayton, Sherry chose not to believe in their validity, and the courts seemed to side with her. Dayton was acquitted of two rape charges that occurred in 1976. Just like the previous assault charges, the rape charges were dismissed by reason of mental defect. However, the charges were downgraded to two counts of coercion. For this offense, Dayton was sentenced to 5 years. He was paroled in January of 1982. In a display of poor judgment, Dayton's parole supervision was terminated after only a year. Sherry stood by Dayton's side as he rebuilt his post-prison life. Dayton established his own small engine repair business in Canby's neighboring town of Woodburn. The business was relatively successful, and for a while, Sherry and Dayton's life together seemed harmonious. So they decided to start a family. Sherry gave birth to a baby boy in 1985. To outsiders, Dayton now appeared to be a happily married new father with a growing business. Sherry had unwittingly helped Dayton conjure this new image of an average working-class family man, but a deep, dark secret was concealed beneath the facade. It all started with a few white lies. Not long after his son's birth, Dayton told Sherry that business was ramping up. He would stay late at work. At first, it was a few extra hours, but after a while, the extra shifts turned into overnights. At Sherry's urging, Dayton hired an assistant to help with the increased workload. But Dayton continued to strategically stay at his shop for extended hours. He apologized to Sherry, but the work just couldn't get done during business hours. In actuality, while Dayton's wife and infant son slept, he was living out his sexually sadistic fantasies. My closet was a vortex of chaos, bursting at the seams with clothes, yet the perpetual lament of having nothing to wear echoed daily. I've shifted to high-quality, affordable pieces from Quince. Now, my wardrobe boasts luxury essentials that seamlessly transition from one occasion to the next. And the best part? I've managed to stay on budget. Welcome to the age of curated style and financial savvy, thanks to Quince. Think 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for just $50, organic cotton sweaters, chic washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And get this, every Quince item is priced at 50 to 80% less than comparable brands. You may be wondering how they do it. Quince takes a unique approach by directly partnering with top factories, eliminating the middleman, and passing on substantial savings to us. Plus, they exclusively collaborate with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, utilizing premium fabrics and finishes, and that's something I really appreciate. I was so impressed with the quality of my 100% Mongolian cashmere sweater. It feels and looks so luxe, and I can't believe it was only $50. You can't go wrong with timeless styles at affordable prices. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/murderish for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/murderish to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/murderish. Ladies, did you know that one of the most common complaints from women about their sexual health is a frustrating low libido? Our sex drives can decline, but it's also treatable. Addy, or flibanserin, is FDA approved and has been clinically proven to increase sexual desire in certain premenopausal women who are bothered by a low libido. So if you feel like you've lost your desire and you want to get it back, stop falling for the snake oils and ask your doctor about Addy today, or go to Addy.com. That's ADDYI.com.
Addy is for premenopausal women with acquired generalized hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, who have not had problems with low sexual desire in the past, who have low sexual desire no matter the type of sexual activity, the situation, or the sexual partner. The low sexual desire is troubling to them and is not due to a medical or mental health problem, problems in the relationship, or medicine or other drug use. Addy is not for use in men or to enhance sexual performance. Your risk of severe low blood pressure and fainting is increased if you drink 1 to 2 standard alcoholic drinks close in time to your Addy dose. Wait at least 2 hours after drinking before taking Addy at bedtime. Your risk of severe low blood pressure and fainting is also increased if you take certain prescriptions, over-the-counter or herbal medications, or have liver problems. Low blood pressure and fainting can happen when you take Addy, even if you don't drink alcohol or take other medicines. Do not take if you are allergic to any of the ingredients in Addy. Allergic reactions may include hives, itching or trouble breathing. Sleepiness, sometimes serious, can occur. Common side effects include dizziness, nausea, tiredness, difficulty falling asleep or staying asleep, and dry mouth. See full PI and medication guide, including box warning at Addy.com/PI, or call 844-PINK-PILL.
Ask your doctor about Addy today, or go to Addy.com. That's ADDYI.com. Let's take a trip into the history of toilet paper. Yes, I said toilet paper. The introduction of perforated rolls came in 1890, but it wasn't until 1930 that we got the luxury of splinter-free tissue. Before that, people made do with corn cobs, parchment, and even pages from the farmer's almanac. Fast forward to today, we're cutting down forests just to produce something we use one time. That's why I love Real Paper. Real revolutionized the toilet paper game with a sustainable twist. Their rolls are tree-free, crafted entirely from 100% bamboo. Recognized by the Forest Stewardship Council, Real ensures responsible harvesting of bamboo grass for their paper production. While typical tree-based toilet papers come swathed in plastic, Real Paper takes a green approach. Their packaging is plastic-free, compostable, and to top it off, they offer free shipping on all orders. Real doesn't stop at being eco-friendly. They've teamed up with One Tree Planted. Every box of Real purchased contributes to reforestation efforts nationwide. Unlike other TP brands that contribute to deforestation, Real actively plays a part in planting trees. I made the eco-friendly swap to Real Paper, and it feels good. Literally. Real Paper is available in easy, hassle-free subscriptions or for one-time purchases on their website. All orders are conveniently delivered to your door with free shipping in 100% recyclable, plastic-free packaging. If you head to realpaper.com/murderish and sign up for a subscription using my code murderish at checkout, you'll automatically get 30% off your first order and free shipping. That's realpaper.com/murderish, or enter promo code murderish to get 30% off your first order plus free shipping. So let's stop flushing our forests and try Real's tree-free paper. Real is paper for the planet. After Jennifer Smith's murder in 1987, detectives used the pickup truck's registration to retrieve an address. It led them straight to Dayton Rogers' repair shop. According to court documents, Clackamas County Police visited the shop at 5:35 a.m. on August 7th. Only a few hours had passed since eyewitness accounts had been called in from Denny's. In that short window of time, Dayton had made an attempt to cover up his crime. As reported in court documents, police observed bloodstains on the passenger side of Dayton's truck. Dayton had tried unsuccessfully to wash it away with a shop rag and a sponge. Latent fingerprints pulled from the passenger side door would later be linked to Jennifer Smith. There were also random knife cuts spotted on the dashboard, ceiling, upholstery, and the passenger door. These findings were enough to arrest Dayton Rogers under suspicion of murder. He was taken to the Clackamas County Jail in Oregon City and held without bail. Acting on a tip from one of Dayton's relatives, detectives circled back to the repair shop. By sifting through ashes inside a wood stove, they found several items. There was what appeared to be a burnt tennis shoe, along with metal fragments, pieces of colored glass, and some rhinestones. The metal bits were similar to pieces found in the parking lot where Jennifer had been killed. But other objects pulled from the ash raised a lot of questions. Jennifer Smith was a known sex worker in the area. Her vocation, paired with the details of Dayton's criminal record, prompted detectives to interview other local sex workers. The accounts varied only slightly. Most of the women interviewed knew Dayton Rogers as Steve the Gambler from Vegas and recognized him when shown a photo. What really stood out to investigators was a common thread in the women's statements. They all told detectives that their dates with Steve involved drinking vodka and orange juice. According to HuffPost, one woman who accompanied a detective to a convenience store was able to pick out the exact brand of orange juice that Steve always purchased. In the interviews, there were countless tales of being bound, bitten, cut, and feeling like their lives were in danger. They'd been forced to endure extreme bondage, and Steve seemed to get off on intense pain and bloodshed. Words of warning about Steve may have been shared with other sex workers in the area, but there were no police reports filed about his behavior. Author Gary C. King theorizes that authorities were not notified for several reasons. Factored into the women's silence was the illegality of sex work and several women having pending arrest warrants. In general, cultural attitudes about violence toward women were different in the 1980s. Other sex workers' interactions with Steve aligned with Dr. Karen Gunson's autopsy of Jennifer Smith. Her body had been horribly mutilated. According to the Oregonian, Dr. Gunson determined that Jennifer sustained at least 11 knife wounds, only one of which was superficial. Her breasts had been slashed, and there were two deep stab wounds to her abdomen. The severing of a major artery in Jennifer's neck had likely caused her death. Jennifer had tried her best to fight off her attacker. Dr. Gunson observed defensive wounds on both of the victim's hands, which had been cut down to the bone. When the case was presented to the Clackamas County Grand Jury, the indictment included several charges. Rogers was charged with aggravated murder, rape, kidnapping, sexual abuse, and torture. The murder of Jennifer Smith had been a heinous crime. With the accused perpetrator behind bars, the whole Portland area felt safer, especially the women who continued to scope out dates on Union Avenue. Steve the Gambler had been a complete brute, but he could no longer infuse fear into their lives. Unfortunately, Dayton Rogers' arrest provided a short-lived sense of relief. As it turned out, there was a lot more to discover about Dayton Rogers and his sick indulgences. On August 31st, 3 weeks after Rogers' arrest, Molalla police received a highly disturbing call. A crossbow hunter tracking his prey had made his way onto a privately owned timber farm. According to the Daily Item, while walking over a heavily wooded hillside, the hunter nearly tripped over human remains. Police arrived to find a nude deceased female, partially covered by ferns. Though the body was badly decomposed, visible injuries made it apparent the woman had been murdered. An extensive investigation followed over the next 5 days. Search parties were formed, and detectives looked to the sheriff's police canine for help. The forest overgrowth proved difficult to comb through, and there was no way of knowing how many victims would be found. Two more bodies were discovered within 50 feet of the first one. Further down a nearby dirt road, three more female corpses in various stages of decomposition were unearthed. All six of the bodies were nude and exhibited signs of mutilation and torture. It was clear to detectives they were dealing with a serial killer, possibly the most prolific in Oregon's history. Some items retrieved at the scene were critical in the investigation. According to court documents, lead detective John Turner found 38 miniature bottles of a particular brand of vodka and 34 orange juice containers at the dump site. There were also pantyhose, shoelaces, rope, and pieces of cloth all tied in knots. Mysteriously, there was also a dog collar and several pieces of wire. Lastly, a knife with human tissue on the blade was found near two of the bodies. The vodka and orange juice bottles made Dayton Rogers flash into investigators' minds, but Rogers was already in police custody and being charged with a different murder. Detectives decided to investigate the six bodies as a separate set of crimes. Tracking down the killer would come with time. For now, investigators prioritized identifying the slain women. Some of the victims were far easier to identify than others. The reason for this was complex. Some of the women could be linked to dental records or defining characteristics. Others were extremely disfigured by their wounds or had been exposed to the elements for far too long. Investigators had their work cut out for them. A task force was formed to include county, state, and federal authorities. According to the Columbian, together, they went through more than 200 sets of dental records in hopes of getting a positive ID. The first victim to be identified was 23-year-old Lisa Marie Mock. As reported by the Albany Democrat Herald, the Berkeley, California native had moved to Portland recently. Dental records led to an ID, and her husband William confirmed it was her. Both Lisa and her husband had several brushes with the law. Most recently, in June, Lisa had been arrested in Portland on a prostitution charge. She had a scheduled court hearing on July 31st. Lisa had failed to appear in court, but it wasn't necessarily cause for concern. Those who knew Lisa understood that she struggled with heroin addiction. An autopsy revealed the trauma done to Lisa's body. According to the Albany Democrat Herald, both of her feet had been sawed off at the ankle and placed underneath her torso. There were multiple stab wounds in her lower back, and a pattern of saw marks appeared on her right thigh, just above the knee. It was difficult for a medical examiner to decide if any of the wounds had been inflicted post-mortem, or if the victim had suffered immensely before her death. Another victim, 26-year-old Maureen Ann Hodges, was identified by her fractured nose. It was an injury her mother, Irene James, recognized from Maureen's childhood. Irene's heart sank when she read that detail in the newspaper. It confirmed her worst fears. Maureen was last seen in early July, but Irene had not reported her missing until September 1st. Known as Mo on the streets, Maureen was a Portland native. Like Lisa, Maureen had battled heroin addiction for several years before her death. She often hitchhiked and shoplifted when she needed drug money. Maureen had resorted to sex work to fund her drug habit. Maureen's mother believed drugs were the direct cause of her daughter's premature death. Irene told the Statesman Journal, "We'll remember her as a happy baby, a curious child, shy and playful. Drugs took Maureen away from us slowly but finally. A sad reflection is that so many families can identify with that." Another victim, 35-year-old Christine Lotus Adams, survived on the streets with a little help from a friend. Tammy Patterson was like Christine's mentor in sex work. Tammy met Christine when they were both 18 and they developed a close friendship. Tammy told the Albany Democrat Herald, "We did what we did so we could survive. Neither of us had any skills to get a good job. We worked to pay the bills and to get things for our kids. No one realized what life is like out there on the street. You find someone good and you hold on to them. That was me and Christine. We hung on to each other." Christine had left home when she was 16 and gotten married a year later. The marriage, though short-lived, resulted in 3 children. Since Christine lived in a series of motels, she sent her kids to live with their grandmother in Dallas. Christine didn't get to see her children often, if at all, but she thought it best to shelter them from her lifestyle. Christine was arrested several times on prostitution charges. Her stepfather, Laverne Flynn, told the Albany Democrat Herald it had been a while since he or her mother had heard from Christine, and that because of her lifestyle, we feared that she was one of the bodies. Christine's injuries were very similar to Lisa Mock's. She had stab wounds on her lower back, and her right foot was severed at the ankle. Adams, Mock, and Hodges were reported missing not long after they were last seen alive. This meant they were easier to identify because they could be linked to a formal report. The victims reported missing months after their disappearance presented a challenge. During the identification process, a glaring similarity emerged. All of them had involvement in the drug or sex trade and led a transient lifestyle because of it. The killer was well aware that these women would not be quickly missed because they moved around a lot. The women who were targeted were living on the periphery of society. The killer must have believed their disappearance would not generate a ton of media attention. Bill Hagland, chief investigator for the King County Medical Examiner, explained why any victim immersed in a similar lifestyle was complicated to identify. As quoted by the Columbian, he said, "You're dealing with individuals who have lost contact with their families. Also, you have the potential of working with people who have had as many as 25 aliases." Over the course of the next year, several of the remaining victims were identified. 20-year-old Cynthia Diane DeVore, who operated under the alias Dee Dee, was reported missing by friends in November of 1987. It was several months after she was last seen. Dental records led to a positive ID, and her family was notified. Cynthia's parents were deeply dismayed at the news of her death, but not entirely surprised. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Nothing is more annoying than having an exciting day planned only to wake up to bad allergies. First world problems, I know, but sometimes allergies ruin my entire day. If you suffer from allergies, I know you understand my struggle. No one wants to go through the day sounding like they're talking underwater. Luckily, we have Astapro. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. Between my daughter's school events, Zoom meetings, and podcast recording sessions, I don't have time to deal with allergy issues. And who wants to listen to a podcast when I sound like this?
Luckily, you don't have to, because I use Astapro for quick and effective relief. You're welcome. Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Murderish listeners, I have to put you on to Blue Land. Blue Land's products aren't just about keeping things tidy. They're also about living greener by cutting down on plastic use. Around 5 billion plastic bottles for hand soap and cleaning get tossed every year. And most of those cleaning solutions are a whopping 90% water, making them really heavy to ship, causing a great deal of carbon emissions. On top of that, they're packed with not-so-great stuff like chlorine and ammonia. It's a lose-lose situation for both you and the planet. Blue Land has a clear-cut mission: ditch single-use plastic by reimagining cleaning essentials to be eco-friendly without compromising on powerful cleaning. They offer refillable cleaning products with a sleek, cohesive design that adds a touch of style to your countertops. Forget about lugging hefty cleaning supplies during your grocery run. Just fill your reusable bottles with water, drop in the tablets, and let them dissolve. And the best part? Refills start at just $2.25, and you can score even more savings with a subscription or bulk purchase. Whether it's cleaning sprays, hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, or laundry tablets, all Blue Land products boast clean ingredients that you can stand behind. Trusted in over a million homes, including mine, Blue Land is making a real impact. One of my favorite things about Blue Land products is how beautiful their bottles look on my countertops. The design is simple and chic, just the way I like it. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners. Right now, get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/murderish. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/murderish for 15% off. That's blueland.com/murderish to get 15% off. We've all heard the saying, two heads are better than one. So why are you still trying to run your business on your own? Just as many criminals need a partner in crime to help them pull off elaborate schemes, you need a partner to help take your business to the next level, and that partner is Shopify. Shopify stands as the global commerce platform dedicated to supporting your business journey at every stage. Whether you're taking the initial steps to launch your online shop, transitioning to your first brick and mortar store, or hitting the remarkable "did we just hit a million orders" stage, Shopify is here to fuel your growth. Whether you're selling sleuthing supplies or marketing mystery merch, Shopify ensures you can sell everywhere. Their all-encompassing e-commerce platform and seamless in-person POS system have your back, no matter what or where you're selling. What sets Shopify apart is its commitment to turning casual browsers into committed buyers, boasting the internet's best converting checkout, a staggering 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And here's where the real magic happens. Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star, streamlines your efforts to sell more with less hassle. When I launched Murderish, I was solely focused on growing the podcast and my business. But once I started hitting those milestones, I realized I needed more support to maintain my growing audience. What I love about Shopify is that no matter how big you want to grow your business, Shopify has all the tools you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Fueling 10% of total e-commerce in the United States, Shopify emerges as the driving force behind major players like Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, as well as countless entrepreneurs spanning 175 countries. Beyond its global influence, Shopify offers a wealth of support resources, ensuring assistance at every stage of your journey towards success. After all, businesses that thrive, thrive with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/murderish, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/murderish now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/murderish. Cynthia had been adopted by Portland natives when she was 11. Her father, Wayne, told the press that Cynthia was a great kid. But in her sophomore year, her high school shut its doors and she was transferred to another school. Cynthia had trouble adjusting after that and often skipped school. That's when the dope took over, Wayne told the Albany Democrat Herald. Cynthia's parents sent her to rehab, but she left after a month and returned to the streets. She had two arrests on her record in December of 1985 and June 1987 for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. At the time of her murder, she was considered a fugitive for not facing those charges. As the parent of a child battling addiction, Wayne DeVore understood that Cynthia's lifestyle could end in tragedy. He told the Oregonian, "We figured Cindy died when she was 15. After she got into dope and changed her name, she was a different person. We were always here. We never abandoned her. We loved her dearly. But she had her choice and she made it." It's believed that Cynthia's body was among the first to be dumped in the Molalla Forest. Her body was found completely skeletonized. Based on autopsies, investigators concluded the victims overall had laid at the dump site for 1 to 3 months. One victim was identified through fingerprints instead of dental records. Nandes K. Cervantes, who everyone referred to as Noni, was a 26-year-old transient from Arizona who had a young daughter. Though her relatives were skeptical that Noni would get into sex work, she had several prior arrests. There was a 1979 charge for indecent exposure, trespassing, and assault charges in 1984. A domestic dispute charge was filed against her that same year. Noni's vice was alcohol. She briefly attended a treatment program, but had great difficulty conquering her habit. Out of all the victims, Noni's body was arguably the most violated by her killer. As reported by the Statesman Journal, her abdomen was split open from below her breastbone to her pubic area using a sharp object. Both of her nipples were severely mutilated. The youngest victim was 16-year-old Retha Marie Giles. Retha had dropped out of high school in 10th grade and then turned to sex work to make quick money. It had been a friend's idea. Wanda Giles explained to the Columbian, "No one wanted to wait 2 weeks for a paycheck. I told her to get a job. She wouldn't listen. She wanted to party." Retha had been arrested twice on prostitution charges in 1987. She alternated between staying with her mom and her 21-year-old boyfriend, Leonard. Leonard told the Columbian that Retha was a sweet, innocent girl, sort of naive, good, and honest. Like all of the other victims, Retha had stab wounds on her lower back. One foot had been sawed off at the ankle, and the bone of her lower left leg had been sawed through. The seventh and final victim buried near the hillside dump site would remain unidentified for more than 25 years. In November of 2013, advancements in DNA made it possible to identify Jane Doe number 7 as 18-year-old Tanya Jerie Johnson. As the investigation moved forward, there were suspicions that a very specific serial killer was to blame, the Green River Killer. The Green River Task Force was sent in to assess if there was any connection between these victims and the 37 women killed in the Pacific Northwest between 1982 and 1984 by Gary Ridgway, one of America's most prolific serial killers. The most glaring similarity was that the victims in both cases were sex workers. But the degree of torture suffered by the victims in Molalla spoke volumes. According to the Daily Item, autopsies showed there were enough medical dissimilarities to indicate there was no correlation between the Green River Killer and the Malala Forest Killer. It wasn't part of the Green River Killer's MO to mutilate his prey. The method of killing was vastly different. The Green River Killer strangled his victims to death. It was abundantly clear the Malala Forest Killer preferred stabbing. The strong belief was they had to be two different killers. The strongest lead into naming the Malala Forest Killer was a Regency Sheffield kitchen knife. That type of knife was found both at the scene of Jennifer Smith's killing and at the Malala site where the bodies were dumped. Paired with the orange juice and vodka bottles, the matching knives pointed investigators straight to Dayton Rogers. The trial for the murder of Jennifer Smith began in February of 1988. Dayton Rogers entered a plea of not guilty on grounds of self-defense. In Rogers' version of events, he claimed Jennifer had tried to rob him and threatened him with a knife. But a defense of justifiable homicide was hardly convincing. The victim had been stabbed 11 times. If convicted, as per Oregon state law at the time, Rogers was eligible for the death penalty. According to the Oregonian, in opening statements, Deputy DA Andy Iglitis called the defendant a vicious predator who killed for a sexual thrill, and that jurors would learn that his sexual appetite included bondage, masturbation, and intent to inflict intense physical pain. Defense attorney Arthur Noss argued that Jennifer Smith had seen more than $200 in Rogers' wallet when they stopped at 7-Eleven. Once they were alone in the parking lot, the victim grabbed a knife from the glove compartment in an effort to steal the money. But witness testimony established a pattern of menacing behavior from Dayton Rogers. Several women who took the stand described interactions that involved being hogtied and cut. The pain he inflicted during their dates was unbearable. Janet K. Anderson was the corrections officer who supervised Rogers during parole for his 1976 coercion conviction. She insisted that Rogers was incapable of remorse. As reported by the Statesman Journal, Anderson recalled, "I asked him if he were to do this all over again, if he would do anything differently. He indicated there would not be a witness next time." In a bold move, Rogers testified in his own defense. He gave an account of Jennifer Smith holding a knife to his throat. Rogers claimed that the victim had pretty much fallen into the knife when he struggled to get away from her. It was an outlandish story that hardly seemed credible. Regardless, Rogers' defense tried to convince the jury that a death sentence was undeserved. As quoted by the Oregonian, defense attorney Noss closed by stating, "What is needed is permanent isolation of this man. In his fantasy land, he's become the sexual monster you've heard about from these girls. He's developed and nurtured these feelings into a ritual. It's a pattern you can't ignore. He's a sick man, but do we kill him? Do we have a death sentence for people who are as sick and depraved as this?" It was a controversial question for the jury to examine. After 4 hours of deliberation, there was a unanimous verdict that Dayton Rogers was guilty of Jennifer Smith's death, and it had been deliberate. One juror expressed strong opposition for the death penalty, and several others followed suit. The jury panel approached the judge with the recommendation of life in prison. As suggested, Judge Patrick Gilroy sentenced Rogers to life. Unbeknownst to the jury, they'd operated under a serious misconception. They thought a life sentence meant that Rogers would be incarcerated for the rest of his life. Detective Turner knew better. At some point down the road, Dayton Rogers would be eligible for parole. The possibility of such a depraved man being free on the streets again did not sit well with law enforcement. The pending trial for the Malala Forest victims was an opportunity to set things right. Lack of sleep was impacting my energy and focus during the day, but then I found my better sleep savior, Bioptimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough. Insomnia can be a symptom of magnesium deficiency, and apparently, 4 out of 5 Americans are magnesium deficient. Since I started incorporating Magnesium Breakthrough into my routine, my sleep has been transformed. I take Bioptimizer's Magnesium Breakthrough during my nighttime skincare routine, and I've been falling asleep faster and staying asleep. Not to mention, it's been great for my workout recovery. It's so important to get a great sleep so I can show up better for my family, my friends, and my podcast team. Unlike other magnesium supplements, Magnesium Breakthrough delivers all 7 essential forms, not just 1 to 2. This unique blend doesn't just improve sleep, it enhances digestion, supports muscle recovery, and promotes overall well-being. From combating migraines and chronic pain to boosting energy and supporting heart health, Magnesium Breakthrough is the natural all-in-one solution. Plus, with optimized absorption, all natural ingredients, and a 365-day money-back guarantee, it's the number one selling product that's constantly improving to end physical suffering. Don't miss out on the most relaxing sleep ever with Magnesium Breakthrough. For an exclusive offer for my listeners, go to buyoptimizers.com/murderish and use promo code murderish during checkout to save 10%. And in addition to the discount you get by using promo code murderish, you can get gifts with purchase, up to 2 travel-size bottles of Magnesium Breakthrough. Act fast. This is a limited-time offer. Go now to buyoptimizers.com/murderish. In the months that followed, Detective Turner and his investigative team worked with the DA's office to solidify their case. In highlighting the severity of Roger's alleged crimes to a grand jury, it was made clear that Dayton Rogers was the most dangerous serial killer the state had ever seen. Dayton Rogers was indicted on 13 counts of aggravated murder. Because the 7th victim had yet to be identified, Rogers couldn't be legally tied to her murder. Once again, Rogers pleaded not guilty, but this time, Christopher E. Burris represented him. Leading up to jury selection, Detective Turner and other Clackamas County detectives interviewed more viable witnesses to testify against Rogers. An all-female jury would decide Rogers' fate for killing 6 women. The much-anticipated trial began on March 30, 1989, and lasted 5 weeks. Prosecutors didn't shy away from the graphic details of the case. These victims had been tormented and disfigured so severely, it was almost surreal. More than a dozen fearless women who'd been lucky enough to survive encounters with Rogers took the witness stand. Their accounts offered a glimpse into the terror and agonizing pain his murder victims had experienced in their final moments. As quoted in Jennifer Chambers' book, one woman recounted that on a date with Rogers, he was biting and tearing. "I told him to please stop. That's too rough. This isn't right. I cried and begged for him to stop. And the more I pleaded and begged, the worse the abuse got. When I screamed too loudly, he became concerned and put something up against my neck, which I assumed was a knife. He told me to be quiet, or else I'd really have something to cry about." Testifying for the defense were a handful of vocational instructors who knew Rogers during his brief stint in prison. They spoke highly of his behavior and eagerness to learn. Psychologist James R. Adams was confident that Rogers only committed violent acts under very specific circumstances and was capable of reform. But any attempt to paint Rogers in a positive light was done in vain. Prosecutors had made sure of it. Some testimony was particularly heart-wrenching. Floria Adams, the 15-year-old daughter of murder victim Christine Adams, said that she recognized star-shaped grommets police had retrieved from Roger's wood stove. With absolute certainty, she testified that the decorative embellishments had come from her mother's pants. Additional forensic evidence included hairs found in Roger's truck that matched three of the victims. There were also the orange juice and vodka bottles at the crime scene, which prosecutors referred to as Roger's signature. According to the Statesman Journal, in his closing argument, Deputy DA Iglaitis proclaimed, "This man is obsessed, totally consumed in a sexual way with a woman's feet and dominance. What is the ultimate act of dominance? It is to remove the foot. We submit that is what happened in the Molalla Forest. The defendant not only committed these murders, but he might as well have written his name on the victims' corpses." It seemed unlikely that the jury would believe the defendant was innocent. Prosecutors were more concerned about Rogers dodging a death sentence again. Only 6 hours into deliberations, the jury found Dayton Rogers guilty of aggravated murder on all counts. Now it was time to recommend a sentence to the judge. Would jurors spare the killer's life or find him deserving of execution? Defense attorney Christopher Burris urged the jury to lock away Rogers for life, not have him executed. He said his client was a sick man, but had proven himself to be a model prisoner. Deputy DA Iglaitis pressed the jury for the death penalty. As quoted by the Oregonian, he said of Rogers, "He can, in every respect, including his appearance, walk among you without giving you any indication of the horrors that are within him." Dayton Leroy Rogers is a walking time bomb. He is an act of criminal violence looking for a place to happen. 17 long hours of deliberation ended on June 7th. According to ABC News, jurors voted unanimously that Rogers had murdered his victims deliberately, and he would continue to be a threat to society, even if kept behind bars. The judge sentenced Rogers to death by lethal injection. As pleased as state prosecutors and the victims' loved ones were by this outcome, it was not the last they'd seen of Dayton Rogers. This is a story without much closure. For years upon years, Rogers appealed. Though the convictions were firmly upheld, he was granted several resentencing hearings due to unusual technicalities. As reported by the Seattle Times, in 1992, the state Supreme Court struck down Rogers' death sentence to comply with a ruling that invalidated Oregon's death penalty law. However, according to court documents, a May 1994 new penalty phase proceeding led to another death sentence. During a hearing in 2000, the court ruled there had been jury misconduct in the previous hearing. The jury had not been informed of the option to sentence Rogers to life without the chance of parole. An appeal was granted and another sentencing hearing was set for 2006. At his 2006 sentencing trial, Rogers spoke about being a changed man after two decades in prison. According to the Seattle Times, he said, "There is never a day that I don't struggle from the very core of my heart and soul over the despicable acts I've committed." Despite his claims of being a changed man, once again, Rogers was sentenced to death, only to have his death sentence overturned once again. Only this time, it was by a governor who opposed the death penalty. Rogers had another hearing in 2015, at which his lawyers called several psychologists to testify. For the first time, the jury heard about Rogers' abusive childhood. Neuropsychologist Ruben C. Gurr testified that the defendant's brain scans revealed he'd suffered brain damage as a result of physical abuse from a young age. There was also mention of Rogers being raised in a cult of religious extremism, though this was never confirmed. Another neuropsychologist, Karen Bronk-Fromming, spoke of how frequently Roger's family moved around and that it must have impacted his social development. According to the Oregonian, she told the jury, "I can't even imagine what his childhood was like. It was extremely fearsome and completely unpredictable." Kevin McGovern, a Portland-based psychologist specializing in forensics and criminal behavior, testified about Roger's exemplary behavior while incarcerated. He said Rogers was working as a barber in prison. He had daily access to sharp scissors so he could cut fellow inmates' hair. As quoted by the Oregonian, McGovern concluded, "I see him basically as a harmless person who is more in danger of being harmed by some inmate who wants a notch on his belt than him harming someone else." Any sympathy the defense could muster was overshadowed by Dayton Rogers' unthinkable crimes. For a fourth time, a jury sentenced Rogers to death. And for a fourth time, the ruling was overturned. Kate Brown, the governor who took office in 2015, was against capital punishment as much as her predecessor. Rogers had dodged execution yet again. There were several delays for a fifth resentencing hearing, partially due to the coronavirus. Finally, in July 2023, Rogers was resentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole at the age of 70. At the time of this recording, Dayton Rogers remains incarcerated at Oregon's Two Rivers Correctional Institution. After decades of uncertainty, Rogers was finally brought to justice, yet there was still unfinished business in Jennifer Smith's case. In 2013, Jennifer Smith's daughter, Sharmole Smith Kaysen, received a voicemail from her estranged father. His message was vague, mentioning there was news about Sharmole's mother. Instead of returning his call, Sharmole hopped online. Googling her mother's name had become something of a habit over the years. Sharmole longed to know more about the mother who'd been ripped out of her life. She was only 6 when her mother was murdered. Sharmole came across a story published by the Oregonian. Through the news article, she learned that Sharmole's grandparents had paid for Jennifer's cremation, but had never retrieved the ashes. For nearly 3 decades, Jennifer Smith's remains sat on a shelf in the mortuary manager's office. One person had never forgotten Jennifer and what she'd gone through. Sherry Letter was at Denny's the night of Jennifer's fatal stabbing. In fact, Sherry stayed by Jennifer's side and tried to stop the flow of blood until an ambulance arrived. The traumatic experience haunted Sherry. Not long after the incident, she mailed a letter of condolence to Jennifer Smith's parents, but it went unacknowledged. Every year, Sherry diligently called the funeral home to ask if Jennifer's ashes had been claimed. Sadly, they hadn't. In 2013, Sherry's call was answered by a new employee. When Sherry shared her story of how she knew Jennifer Smith, the employee was deeply moved. At this employee's prompting, the funeral home donated an urn to hold Jennifer's remains, and they held a simple service for her. After coming across the Oregonian article, Sharmole rushed to Portland. She got to meet Sherry and pick up her mother's ashes. In a follow-up article in the Oregonian, Sharmole commented, "I feel closure. There's a weight off me. I feel like a whole chapter has closed." Sharmole was overcome with gratitude for Sherry's actions. Though she was a complete stranger, Sherry had comforted Jennifer in her final moments. As quoted by the Oregonian, Sharmole told Sherry, "I'm so glad you were there with her. She needed somebody." All of Dayton Rogers' victims needed somebody. Some of the women he lured into his truck were fortunate enough to survive. Others had their lives taken, for the momentary indulgence of a madman. It's human to need support and connection in this world. Rogers exploited the humanity of others because he was naturally inhumane. Without the tragedy of Jennifer Smith's death, the remains of Lisa Marie Mock, Maureen Ann Hodges, Christine Lotus Adams, Cynthia Diane DeVore, Nandis K. Cervantes, Rita Marie Giles, and Tanya Jury Johnson may have never been connected to Dayton Rogers had it not been for Jennifer Smith's strong will to fight for her life. Rogers may have gotten away with murder. The most chilling part of this case might be not knowing if there are still other victims out there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Murderish. Make sure you're subscribed to Murderish wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss any new episodes. If you enjoy Murderish, please consider leaving a positive rating and review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now. Are you watching a lot of true crime documentaries and want a community of like-minded people to talk about them with? Join the True Crime TV Club I started. We call ourselves the Serial Streamers, and we meet in my Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube comments a couple times a month to dish about all the crazy true crime docs we're watching together. If you want to join Serial Streamers, all you have to do is follow me on Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube at Jamie On Air. That's J-A-M-I On Air, and watch for videos about the latest TV series we're watching together, so you can join us in the comments and share your thoughts. That's Jamie On Air on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. This episode was researched and written by Allison Schwartz. Visit murderish.com for a list of sources used for this episode. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, listening to this podcast doesn't make you a murderer. It just means you're murder-ish. Murderish listeners, I need your help with a missing persons case. Liam Byron has been missing since May 9th, 2019. The then 32-year-old went on a trip a month earlier to visit family in Israel, spend time in northern Italy's wine country, and then visit France. Liam was traveling alone and was due to fly out of Paris back to the United States on May 16th. He never showed up for his flight. Liam is described as a white male who's 5'8" tall and weighs roughly 160 pounds. He has brown hair and brown eyes, with a large gap between his two front teeth. The Marlboro, New Jersey native was living in Jefferson, Louisiana, and worked in New Orleans before his travels. Liam's credit card was used on May 9, 2019 to purchase a train ticket from Turin, Italy to Italy's Aosta Valley. His personal belongings were found in a remote location in the valley. Liam is a travel and wine blogger, known to stay in hostels while abroad. He's known to be friendly with fellow travelers. Anyone with information about Liam's whereabouts should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or your local FBI office.